Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Yesterday, May 11th, was the 224th anniversary of Discovery Day, when Boston Captain Robert Gray sailed into the Great River of the West in 1792 and named it after his ship, Columbia Rediviva, Columbus Reborn. Some folks think a native name for the river was a derivative of Oregon. May 11th is also Bloody Monday, the day in 1970 that Portland SWAT police attacked anti-war Portland State students and Vietnam veterans on the PSU campus. The local protest at PSU was part of a nationwide college strike against the U.S. invasion of Cambodia. The country has since been relatively docile about such use of America's all-volunteer forces. U.S. Army Captain Nathan Smith, a veteran of Afghanistan, is suing President Obama for sending troops against ISIS in Syria without congressional declaration of war. If these soldiers were draftees, there would probably be a national howl of protest. You might remember Oregon and Massachusetts attempts to pass legislation that would prevent draftees from being sent into undeclared wars. And by the way, the Portland's SWAT, or tactical platoon, was originally organized to combat what was called black insurrection. Its first use, however, was against primarily white college students and a few Vietnam vets on Bloody Monday. And Tuesday, May 10th, would have been the 76th birthday of Arthur Honeyman, who died December 8th, 2008, which was itself a prominent date in Astoria history, the Great Astoria Fire of 1922. Arthur was born with cerebral palsy. He was a teacher, poet, writer, and fervent advocate for physically handicapped. More about Arthur later in the program. Now to the present. May 17th is Oregon Primary Day, and that is what this program is about. As most of what I'm about to say is primarily my opinion, I should disclaim that it is my opinion and perhaps my opinion only, which could be likened to the transit of planet Mercury across the sun. Oregon Primary Day by me. American political campaigns are wars without armies or guns, though they are predictably as vicious and bitterly fought between opponents. Guile, deceit, treachery, and stockpiles of money are a campaigner's weapons. Politics, as has been said many times, but always needs repeating, is the only adult game. It is also the dirtiest, defying almost every attempt at reform, simply because the stakes are too high to leave anything to chance. Another favorite maxim, which applies particularly to gambling and politics, is that if you're not cheating, you're not trying hard enough, which leads to the conundrum that you possibly might not deserve to win at politics or poker unless you do cheat. The presidential campaign of 2016 has been mean, nasty, often below the belt and seldom above the collar, and interminably long. It has intensified the split between the few who have prospered and the many who have been destituted. So far, it has not been conducted with assassinations, other than of character, nor with terrorism, imprisonment, or death threats to candidates, at least by other candidates. Dark money exacerbates the noxious tenor of this election and has also frustrated its donors, although it is already among the most expensive elections on record. This election does give American voters the opportunity to elect the first woman president to follow the first black American man as president. And it presents, if simplistically, two sides of the populist coin. A male candidate who represents democracy by his insistence on political and economic equality. The other espouses the barbarity of fear and hatred and has also threatened mob action like the old Romans if he isn't nominated at the GOP convention. The election finally reaches Oregon on May 17th, with its once important primary now diluted by a fierce competition among states to have increasing power in the selection of a national government and thus within it. Oregon's primary is party specific, like most primaries. Only voters registered in the two major parties are eligible to vote, though there is consistent pressure for an open primary. Now that we are at the cusp of the Oregon primary, it seems as though we pick through the bodies after the war is over. The contest that has virtually splintered the country has been fought in states deemed more crucial to the election. There has been a flurry of new voter registrations in Oregon and also party crossovers, but it probably won't matter much except symbolically. The campaign juggernaut has essentially rendered Oregon impotent before it was even our turn. Oregon registers as a faraway place from everywhere else, even by its neighbors, an ecotopian wasteland of salmon, beaver, and Grateful Dead concerts. Oregon is a Democrat enclave, but also a posse militia homeland. The KKK was once very big here, and an anti-gay group, Oregon Citizens Alliance, came breathtakingly close to a Nazi-like witch hunt of gays and lesbians via initiative petition. And it is the only state that banned blacks in its original constitution. Homespun right-wing militia members are campaigning for local ballots this primary. Oregon even had an ugly law that made it a crime for, quote, diseased, maimed, or deformed, unquote, persons to appear in public. Yet Oregon has a reputation as a progressive state. Vote by mail is certainly a part. Land use laws, legal marijuana, gay rights and marriage, public beaches, and Oregon is known for its civility. The general perception is that Republican and Democratic parties are converging into a single plutocratic party, and everybody else is forced out into the fringes. Yet significant differences remain. The Republicans act paranoid in their attempts at exclusivity, each campaign a further withdrawal from the incredibly and increasingly diverse mass of citizenry, while the Democrats, more by default, reflect that diversity, perhaps because it has no other home as a result of GOP rejection and the unpopularity and powerlessness of third parties. The Democratic Party is traditionally the party of working people and minorities, though its history is hardly glorious, in particular its advocacy of Southern apartheid in the 19th century. The Democrats usually, though reluctantly and always narrowly, encompass a mixed variety of ideas, philosophies, and cultural styles that would otherwise find expression in other parties, which generally have little chance against the prevalent two-party system. Jammed uncomfortably into this single political party alongside a now virtually vanished core of strict constructionists are liberals, leftists, trade unionists, environmentalists, minority groups, feminists, and others who might be regarded as freethinkers, progressives, and heretics. Self-proclaimed as the party of the people, though once considered the party of traitors, the party of secession, of disenfranchised workers and immigrants, the Democrats have in their campaigns favored such liberal causes as labor reform, busing to achieve racial integration in public schools, gay rights, abolishing capital punishment, greater representation in politics by women, blacks, and young people, the 18-year-old vote. And Democrats have been in the forefront of demands that war be abolished as a nation's major instrument of world power. Paradoxically, for Republicans, the power to make war is the essential leverage for world power. In this, the GOP shares the view of FDR and every president since World War II, that the immense wealth and power of the U.S. makes it responsible for world leadership, quote unquote. This, more than any other reason, has split the Democratic Party the past half century. The ineffable question about the coexistence of raw power with civil rights. While the Republican Party generally represents the aspirations and pretensions of wealthy Tories and plutocrats, and would more likely include proto-Nazis than fuzzy-headed liberals, the Democrats switched their antebellum loyalties at the end of the 19th century to embrace the hordes of impoverished Mediterranean and Eastern European immigrants who were imported to work in the rapidly expanding American industrial machine, which was primarily in the hands of Republicans. The old cadre of Democrat Party bosses were never comfortable with the mix of political ideas these people brought with them, but liked their numbers. The Democratic Party found its platform from increasingly mixed socialist and so-called liberal reforms in the 1930s. And in the 1930s, the Democrats under Franklin Roosevelt engineered a major redefinition of government's role in American society. Often accused since then as the party of the left, the Democrats usually attempt to fix the national political structure after rapacious Republicans tear it apart with corruption, mismanagement, and egregious hate campaigns against political adversaries, mainly women, liberals, and racial minorities. The real bankruptcy of the Democratic Party in recent times is that it has done little to stem the wild surge to the right in American politics, but has instead accommodated it with opportunistic envy. With only two parties through which to represent their ambitions, mainstream politicians show little interest in responding to minority concerns, or, in fact, to registering into the parties the millions of blacks, Hispanics, or Caucasian poor who seldom participate in politics. Although their involvement would swell party ranks, especially during elections, it would also broaden the base of each party and threaten the status quo. The two-party system does not represent the incredible variety and tenor of American politics, and that especially in recent years, as population and cultural diversity have multiplied immensely, the two parties seem to be merging into a single mega-party dominated by a country club apartheid of wealth, property, and multinational corporations. A new or third party is necessary to represent the unrepresented majority that does not possess equivalent wealth, property, or power, and also to reflect true gender and racial equity. Several new parties, in fact. It might seem pertinent to suggest an alternative of international political parties if we are to have a global economy dominated by amalgamated mega corporations, which are fundamentally interlocking commercial empires that command vast wealth, capacity, and political influence. Parochial politics are inadequate to the global power structures that are forming beyond the shores of the USA, yet are dominated by its economic and military power. In a world community, political parties as well as labor unions must think and act globally. In other words, the globalization of political power, in particular for the representation of the immense and rapidly expanding global underclass. The paradox is that the United States simultaneously acts worldwide as the new Rome, intruding incessantly into global political, economic, and military affairs, while rejecting global influence in its own internal affairs. One opinion originating in Europe, but perhaps felt all over the world, is that American presidential elections in particular should be a worldwide suffrage. Two Americas have developed this new millennium, one immensely wealthy and privileged, the other exploited and heavily taxed, with separate sets of laws governing each. The continuing decline of the middle class has also dried up much of the voluntary work it has provided at every level of society. Hospitals, churches, works of relief such as charities and food and clothing programs, and thousands of every type of civic and social committees. The poor cannot afford the money or time to provide such community service. The wealthy are seldom concerned, except to co-opt or extinguish whatever works on behalf of the destitute. The owners of capital own the press, the Congress, the armed forces, and nearly every other vital instrument of state, in the view of V.I. Lenin, who was certain that liberation of the appeased classes was impossible without a violent revolution and destruction of the apparatus of the state. Karl Marx spoke about the inevitability of history as if it were a primary momentum that by its own iron necessity, and that's a quote by Marx, iron necessity, progresses toward the breaking up of nations and obliteration of the rich and powerful, resulting in the triumph of the wage owner. We think of Marx, Lenin, and their communism as history's failures. In the 1930s, the Great Depression was thought to spell the doom of capitalism. Many Americans believed that U.S. society was not merely doomed, but did not deserve to survive because it had failed its people. Its institutions were not just unworthy of preservation, but should be eradicated. Capitalists were under attack, their values repudiated, their careless, unconcerned greed held responsible for the ruin of society. Bankers and businessmen were found as guilty of crimes against the nation as the 1950s were to despise domestic communists. The American dream, so extolled by flimflammers, appeared flawed and fatally cracked during the Depression's early years, and radical reformers tried to dismantle the doomed structure. Most Americans, however, did not believe their system was mortally ill, despite the ruthless aspects of capitalism that caused the sickness. Its decline was far more astonishing than its subsequent recovery. When Franklin Delano Roosevelt became president in 1933, he perceived that democratic capitalism could only survive and prosper if the basic principles of democracy were applied to achieve economic and social justice, as well as civil and political freedom. FDR utilized what his enemies called socialist reforms to save democracy in the United States. Democracy as a pragmatic compromise between the longing for freedom and the urge to subjugate it is incomplete in its concentration on political rights without enough attention placed upon economic or social rights. The problems of meeting the needs and demands of ever larger segments of disenfranchised Americans in an increasingly complex and accelerating society create a paradoxical response of hardening hearts and desires for simpler solutions when people look for answers simplified into dogma. The cultural dialogue narrows considerably. Complex social questions are reduced to an us or them snarl. The most clamorously ignorant demand that their vengeful fables be legislated into political truth and rule. In the names of freedom and justice, both are eroded. It is difficult to resist the inversion that permeates the cultural heart. At the root of radical political myth is the claim there are no neutrals in the great struggle to eliminate tyranny and poverty, or to maintain them. But in real life, most people prefer to be neutral. They would rather work to improve their lot within a familiar structure than risk the imponderables of a new one. As the Longview Daily News once put it, garbage disposal, safe drinking water, groundwater contamination, sewage problems, and toxic wastes are more on people's minds than overthrowing existing government. It is not so much poverty, inequality, or repression that bring out the clamor for change, but more usually the fear of losing familiar comforts already attained. Change disrupts, and the changes necessary to redistribute the power and control of the nation's wealth to a majority of the people will be dramatic and unsettling. There will not be an instant transfer of power, nor will it ever be complete. Underneath the plethora of serious problems battering the nation is the most important of all, the growing inequality between social and economic classes in a society that smugly and blindly claims to be classless. As the importance of wealth, no matter how attained, assumes greater influence, the political and legal inequities between the wealthy and less wealthy are vastly accentuated. America has seldom been kind or generous to its minorities and poor. Each time an outcast population struggles for equality, the powerful and others who hate or fear diversity or do not wish to share wealth or power attempt to squash the individuals and movements responsible, usually in the names of law and order and or national security. Yet forcing the poor and minorities to remain in poverty and despair is ultimately calamitous to the nation. For one thing, the real best and brightest are kept out, and all of us in the long run suffer for it. The final analysis is human rights, that no matter what else might occur, everything reverts back to the most ancient struggles of rich against poor. Whatever masks or complexities surround ideologies, their design is to either protect privilege and power or establish and extend rights and liberties of the powerless. The test of our progress is not whether we add more to the abundance of those who have much, FDR said, to perk up the hard struggle to end the Great Depression. It is whether we provide enough to those who have too little. Democratic Socialist presidential candidate Bernie Sanders said when he was Vermont's representative in Congress, if democracy is going to survive in this country, tens of millions of poor and working people are going to have to see the connection between their economic condition and the political process. They must vote not for the lesser of two evils, but for jobs, income, health care, and the dignity to which they as human beings are entitled. Only when that occurs will American democracy become revitalized. Human beings cannot escape history is the Marxian idea, but human beings make their own history. Freedom and equality, like love, begin at home. Now I'd like to read something else I wrote, and it was quite a few years ago when I wrote it. It's when Arthur Honeyman comes back into the program, as I mentioned earlier. Spastic politics, nothing to lose. One wintry night, Arthur Honeyman warmed himself sipping a wine known locally as Red Death. He and a friend were well into the evening and a gallon jug. Politically romantic, tending to the left side of things in a poetic sense, Honeyman was deciding if he should try for the Oregon legislature a third time. His first two attempts were unsuccessful because he was a peripheral candidate, campaigning on what was considered a limited political issue, the social and political needs of the physically handicapped. His friend was urging him to run, but Arthur was reluctant. The antithesis of political charisma, slobbering, shaking spastically in a cart, hardly able to talk, Honeyman was aware he would still be regarded as a freak, even among voters and peers who shared his opinions on issues. The first two campaigns had a certain sense of theater that appealed to him. He had been a symbol. He stood for the miserable conditions and hardships the physically handicapped experienced daily. His appearance on the political scene had its desired shock effect. The unseen, untouchable became visible and piercingly embarrassing with his accusations of neglect and his demands of social and political equality. Even the physically handicapped were taken aback because Honeyman was urging them to take political action themselves by refusing the dependency society was forcing on them. He lost, but losing did not diminish his excitement and satisfaction in trying. Personally, his major satisfaction was committing the unpardonable heresy of exposure. The catalytic visions of himself on the nightly news, staring at people in their homes, pinning them to their own walls, amused him. Arthur had once been arrested in a Portland pancake house under the infamous ugly law for public display of his spasticity. But a third try was a different question. The symbolic shock politics were exhausted. He certainly was not a household name, but neither was he an alien apparition. Pressure was on him from the liberal arm of the Democratic Party. Honeyman was advised that he had to go for broke if he ran. Otherwise, his presence on the platform would diminish the strength the Liberal Democrats were shooting for. Politically, Honeyman had stereotyped himself as a freak. That was suicide. And he told his friend, almost nostalgically, he was bailing out of electoral politics. "I'm too radical," he said. "Honeyman, when it comes down to it, you're a damn liberal." He shook his head. "No, I'm a radical. A liberal is someone who thinks he or she is sane and wants to do good, sane things for the rest of the insane world. Radicals know they're as insane as the rest of humanity. A radical is desperate, has nothing to lose, and pities no one. A liberal has everything to lose and condescends to pity. Nothing is going to change for me. I'm a spastic, and I've got nothing to lose." "Conservatives wish cripples were non-existent," Honeyman said, "and liberals claim with a smile that cripples are just as human as they are. But radicals," he said, "think everyone is crippled." He took a long sip of his wine through a straw and spastically leered at his friend. "Do you have any more questions?" he asked. And that appeared in a magazine for Portland State, Metropolis, in 1974. And I'd like to finish the program with a poem by Sparrow, the poet candidate. "Why are we here? We're here because we want time. And what kind of time do we want? TV time. And what kind of TV time do we want? Free TV time. And whom do we want free TV time for? Me. And why do I need free TV time? From NBC, which is giving it to all presidential candidates, so I can denounce TV. I have proof that television is the most fear-inducing, community-exploding, mind-boiling device in history. But how can I communicate this message to the American people so that they will listen carefully? And how can I reach them in their own homes where they are most vulnerable? I must go on television, which is why I am demanding equal time, completely equal time, with the other candidates. Besides, all the other candidates are speaking prose, vast, uninterrupted, listless prose. Only I am speaking a flowing, lyric, olive-colored poetry. This is a contradiction. I am the only poet candidate, yet I am shut out of the dialogue or trialogue. Where are our checks and balances? When prose predominates, the earth becomes too flat. When poetry is overweening, the world becomes too round. And which would you rather have, my sister and fellow tourists? A world too flat or a world too round? And that was by Sparrow, the poet candidate. Sparrow, aka Michael Daniel Gorlick, is a poet, writer, and perennial presidential candidate. He wrote this poem during the infamous 2000 election year, which was his second candidacy. You can read Sparrow in the fabulous magazine, The Sun. And this has been Michael McCusker. Happy primary day.